Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's Thursday, March 18th, and we're in the middle of the census chapter. We'll probably finish that up today. We were talking about hearing last time, and as a matter of fact, we're talking about a number of special senses. What's a big difference between a general sense and a special sense? What's a general sense? Yeah, maybe a definition and then some examples. A general sense is sensation from all over your body because you have receptors all over your body. And what do you, give me an example of a receptor that you have millions of or thousands of that are populated all over your body. Pain receptors, temperature receptors, vibration, proprioception, right? And give me an example of a special sense. And why is it a special sense? Yeah, there are receptors only in one area for that particular modality, like vision, taste, smell, hearing, and equilibrium, two kinds of equilibrium, which we have talked about already. Okay, what are the two kinds of equilibrium? Static and kinetic. And we're going to talk about the parts of the ear responsible for that. But what the heck, let's review just a little bit. Static equilibrium, what part of the ear is involved with static equilibrium? And I'm thinking too much. I'm not listening to what you're saying. Static equilibrium is the maculae inside the vestibule of the ear. And kinetic equilibrium comes from the semicircular canals. Yeah, so we're going to look at the bony labyrinth, membranous labyrinth, the organs responsible for that, and the cells responsible. What's the cell responsible for both static and kinetic? Yeah, the hair cells, right? So the hairs bend back and forth, and so you should know something about the structure of the crustampularis and the maculae that bend the cells. All right, so let's move on to hearing. So here we have a diagram that shows the external ear, the middle ear, and the internal ear. What is the bony labyrinth involved with hearing? And I see it rolled out. On a kind of like on a stage right here. You could call it a piano, but that probably wouldn't be good. What do you call that thing in your inner ear? The cochlea, right. You have the cochlea, and then sound enters the cochlea via this oval window, and it moves around through the fluid, okay, the perilymph. So we got the scale of vestibuli. So scale of vestibuli is connected up to the oval window. And then that pressure is released via the perilymph that's in the scale of tympani right here that's connected up to the round window. So the round window vibrates back and forth. What are the two characteristics of a wave that I mentioned earlier? How do we talk about a wave? The frequency, yeah, which is related to the wavelength, right? As the wavelength gets longer, the frequency gets lower and lower in pitch. Right, and what was the other one? The amplitude, right? The amplitude of a wave. Okay, so sound, any kind of wave can exist in a substance very easily depending upon the shape of that particular substance. And I want to relate that to the cochlear duct right here, because there's an organ inside this cochlear duct that depolarizes and generates action potentials and sends those action potentials to the brain based on frequency. So if we look at this cochlea, the end over here is what we call the helicotrema, and the frequencies that can excite this end of the cochlea are low frequencies, right, like in the regions of hundreds of hertz. And then this region of the cochlea here can vibrate to mid-range frequencies, and high frequencies vibrate in this region right here. And so really what I want you to do is picture a piano or a harp or something, and in your mind, as a matter of fact, I got a picture right here. I have to stop the slideshow. Okay, so it goes. I'll start it up again. All right, so how can a piano or a harp produce different frequencies? Because the strings have a different what? They have a different length, and as if we were to look really, really close, we would also notice that there's a different thickness. But strings have a different length, So let's just pay attention to length. So here the strings are very, very short. What kind of frequencies will strings produce if they're very, very short? High frequencies. And if they're very long, they're going to produce very low frequencies, right? And the cochlea is in this particular arrangement as well. So let me go back to a picture of a cochlea. All right, here it is all laid out in a linear fashion, but we know the cochlea really looks like what? Like this snail all curved up right here. So you might think that the helicotrema, which is what? This inner part of the cochlea is the small, narrow end, which might vibrate at a high frequency. But I want to show you that that's actually a very long, that's the long end, that's the big end of the cochlea. And maybe this demonstration right here might show you that. Let's go to DocCam. All right, so here we got a picture of just the head of this violin right here. This is what we call a scroll. And if I put it on edge, like this, what does it kind of remind you of? Yeah, it kind of just looks like the cochlea. I don't know if that helps. Does that help maybe a little bit? Okay, so that's a scroll. And it kind of looks like a cochlea, right? You can unroll it. And so where would the helicotrema of the cochlea be on this scroll right here of a violin? Yeah, right here in the center. Okay, well, if we put it in a little bit different angle, if I move it like this, what's the widest part of the scroll right here, or the cochlea? It would be the helicotrema, right? So the helicotrema is going to vibrate at the lowest frequencies. Why? Because it's the widest part of the cochlea, which you can't really appreciate in the illustrations that you have. But you know, if I turn this violin around, can you still kind of picture that this is the widest part right here? So in terms of the organ of Corti or the cochlea, this is the one that's going to vibrate at the lowest frequency, and this part here will vibrate at the highest frequency because it's the most narrow part of the cochlea. Okay? So if we were to roll, let me get close to the board right here. So we got the oval window right here, and if we look down at the cochlea from the top, like we're looking right here, and roll it out, what's going to be the shape of the cochlea as we roll it out? Right, so here's the cochlea that's all rolled up. We're looking from the side, but let's look down from the top view. What is the cochlea going to look like? Yeah, it's going to look like this, where this is the helicotrema, right? So this is the longest dimension, and so these are going to respond to low frequencies as a result. Let me start this show again. All right, so the helicotrema is going to respond to low frequencies, and that's what we see on this illustration right here. All right, so sound will enter the scale of vestibuli, and depending on the width of the cochlea, it's going to move across the cochlear duct right here. And as it moves through the cochlear duct, it's going to produce vibrations in the cochlear duct, depending on the frequency. Okay, so that's why I like to think of the cochlear duct as actually being a piano. Okay, all right, so as sound moves from the scala vestibuli into the scala tympani, it goes through this cochlear duct, and inside the cochlear duct, there is a special organ for the production of action potentials that relate to a particular frequency in the cochlear duct. Okay, so here is the organ of Corti. So let's zoom into the organ of Corti. So we've zoomed right in, and I think these pictures are from your textbook. All right, so sound is going to move through this area, and when it does, it's going to vibrate, right, this tectorial membrane. And those vibrations then, the movement of this tectorial membrane, are going to deform the stereocilia of these hair cells. And that's going to produce depolarization in these hair cells, and that's going to produce action potentials in the auditory nerve, taking it to the brain so that you have the perception of sound. And each one of these nerve fibers here is going to be carrying information to the brain based on frequency, a particular frequency depending on where these hair cells are located within the cochlea. All right, and could you describe where the sounds within the cochlea are going to come from by frequency? What would be the two ends of the organ of Corti or the cochlea? You got one region that's close to the oval window, and the other end that's close to the helicotrema, and the one by the helicotrema is going to reproduce what? Low frequencies. Okay. So this tectorial membrane will vibrate depending on where it is located within the organ of Corti. And then individual nerve fibers will take signals, right, from that spiral organ into the medulla, and in particular, what do I want you to know? Well, maybe you should know something about the inferior colliculus in the midbrain. All right, so we have two neurons. Here is the vestibular cochlear nerve. Here's a second order neuron that takes it from the medulla into the midbrain, the inferior colliculus, and then from the inferior colliculus up to the thalamus. And what the heck is the job of the thalamus? It redirects signals to the cerebral cortex to the particular region, to the special region responsible for that particular modality. And in the temporal lobe, so here's a temporal lobe right here, that's the region responsible for the perception of sound. All right, this region up over here, right, this would be, for instance, like in the post-central gyrus, if this area were to depolarize, you would have the sensation on the surface of your body. Right, but you want to appreciate sound, so those action potentials should go to the auditory cortex in the temporal lobe. The inferior colliculus right here is an important reflex center because it can help you localize sound. It can tell you where sound is coming from. Like right now, you can't tell by listening to me where I'm standing in the room because why? If you were just to listen to me. Because of the speakers, there's sound coming out all those speakers. But if I were to turn the speakers off, all right, you could tell where I was standing where just by listening to my voice. You could tell if I was on the right-hand side of the room or the left-hand side or in the back of the room because sound will arrive at your two ears at two different times. And the inferior colliculus then can measure the time difference between the arrival of that sound. And based on that, you can say, you can determine the position of where that sound is originating from. Okay, so the thalamus here is a relay center for sensory information so that it goes to the proper part of the brain. And maybe in your textbook, you see that there are different neurons that go to different parts of the temporal lobe. And if we were to map out the frequency in each part of the temporal lobe, we would see that there's low frequency on this end and high frequency. So if we were to stimulate this end of the auditory cortex, you would hear a low note. If we were to stimulate this part of the cortex, you would hear a high note. So actually, what exists in your temporal lobes? That's very similar to what exists in the cochlea. There's really a piano there as well, right? So depending on what area depolarizes, you will hear a different tone. Okay? And it's arranged exactly like it is in the cochlea. By frequency. Okay, so that is hearing. So let's write on the board some things I think that are pretty important for you to know. All right, so let's start with a particular sense. What are the three senses associated with the ear? You've got hearing, you've got static equilibrium, and you've got kinetic. All right, and then we got a number of different parts of the ear. What are the three main parts of the ear? You got the outer or external, you got middle. Can you picture that in your mind, the middle part between the tympanic membrane and the oval window? All right, and then you've got the internal ear. For hearing, what parts of the ear do you need in order to hear something? You need all three, right? You need the outer, you need the middle, and the internal. What about for static equilibrium? You need your external ear for static equilibrium? You know what? You do not. So no. Middle ear. Nothing in there. You don't need those auditory ossicles for equilibrium XXX, but the internal ear, you sure do, right? And we're going to talk about what some of those pieces are, or review what some of those pieces are in a little bit. And the same thing for kinetic equilibrium. Does not require outer ear, does not require middle ear, but it does require inner ear. And in particular, all right, what part? We're going to call this the bony labyrinth. All right, which is in the petrous region of the temporal bone. What is the bony labyrinth for hearing called? That's the cochlea. All right, the bony labyrinth for static equilibrium is the vestibule. And the bony labyrinth for kinetic equilibrium, which is what? Oh, yeah, we should define what those equilibriums are. That is what the semicircular canals. Seems if I turn the microphone upside down, it behaves a lot better. Semicircular canals, cochlea. Okay. What is the sense of static equilibrium? Or equilibrium will sense what kind of thing? It's going to sense changes in velocity, right? Not constant velocity, but changes in velocity. What do we call changes in velocity? Acceleration or deceleration. So for static equilibrium, what kind of acceleration is that? Linear acceleration, as opposed to kinetic equilibrium will sense angular acceleration. All right, so don't forget, acceleration is a change in velocity, either linear velocity or a spinning change in velocity, which we call angular acceleration. All right, so from each of these bony labyrinths right here, there is an organ responsible for each of these senses. What are the organs responsible for that? So you should have a picture in your mind what those little organs look like. All right, the organ inside the cochlea is the, kind of gives it away, organ of Corti. Right, the tectorial membrane, it's got a basement membrane, all that kind of stuff. All right, and for linear acceleration, what are those things? The maculae. Can you picture a maculae? What's something really strange about maculae that maybe that you learned in this class? What does a maculae contain? It's got those little crystals in there. So you have those crystals that participate in detecting linear acceleration. They act as weights that can pull or push on a hair cell. All right. And what about kinetic equilibrium? What's the organ for kinetic equilibrium? It's in that little ampule, a little bulge at the base of a semicircular canal, the crista ampullaris. All right, crista ampullaris. And then lastly, just for fun, what are the cells, the receptor cells? So I tell you what, before we talk, you tell me what the receptor cells are. What are they sensitive to? What modality of energy? Is it going to be these chemoreceptors, photoreceptors? They're mechanical receptors, right? So they respond to bending. Bending of the plasma membrane because of the stereocilia. All right, so what's the name of the receptor cell in the organ of Corti? That's a hair cell. What about for static equilibrium? Hair cell, same thing. And for kinetic equilibrium, it's a hair cell as well. So it's the same kind of cell with modifications within these different organs, right, that produce these different sensations. And you perceive them as different sensations because these hair cells basically just produce action potentials, but those action potentials produce different sensations. Why is that? Why do action potentials, all these action potentials are the same, but they produce different sensations based on what? Because they go to different parts of the brain. And what's the major part of the brain that tells those action potentials to go to different parts of the cerebral cortex? The relay center is the thalamus that does that. Okay? Okay, so that's it for hearing. Okay, vision. We're going to be interested in waves again for vision, but these kinds of waves are not mechanical waves. Did I give you the sign-in sheet already? Yeah, good. Okay. These are electromagnetic waves, right? But they're characterized by frequency, and they're characterized by amplitude as well, just like kind of like a sound wave. And based on the frequency or the wavelength of light, right, we can make a whole spectrum right here. So very long waves are radio waves. Very high frequency waves are gamma rays. And as we move up in frequency, or as the wavelength actually decreases, the frequency increases, all right, the energy of that particular wave increases as well. So these waves down here are not harmful to biological compounds, but these wavelengths up over here, like gamma rays and X-rays, could you tell me about these? Very damaging, because they're very, very high energy. And somewhere in between, right, we have this visible light. And at a little bit higher frequency to visible light, we have ultraviolet light. And even ultraviolet light is damaging to biological tissues, right? That's been on the news a bunch. And what kind of apparatus produces all of these different wavelengths right here that you have to be kind of concerned with? The sun, right, okay. And our atmosphere does a nice job of filtering these of gamma rays and X-rays out of the sun, so we don't have to worry about that, but ultraviolet light does come through the atmosphere. And what does that produce on people's skin if you go out in sunlight? Yeah, it will burn, right, but that can also damage DNA. All right. These wavelengths right here produce different colors. And this is what our eye can detect, what we call the visible light spectrum. So you could put spectrum right here. And a spectrum is just a fancy name for what common English word would you use? What is this right here? This is a rainbow. Okay, so the visible light spectrum is just the rainbow that's produced. So the sun produces all of these wavelengths, and if we put red and orange and yellow and green and blue and all these colors together, guess what we get in the human eye? We get actually white. Okay, we get white. And black is a color that's absent of all these different colors right here. It's an absence of light. All right, so I think you talk about some of this stuff in lab, maybe not to the extent we're going to talk about it in here. But here is the pupil, and this is the iris. And what's the job of the iris? Just like on a microscope that you've used, right? It adjusts the amount of light that can enter the eye to protect the retina, which is the photosensing part of the eye. And there's a hole in the iris that we call the pupil, right? So the pupil is not really a structure. It's basically a foramen within the iris. All right, so, and the pupil constricts or dilates depending on what muscles are contracting. Okay, and so here we see two different arrangements of muscle. We see a circular smooth muscle, and then we see some longitudinal smooth muscle that's arranged in a radial fashion. All right, so that in dim light, we want the pupil to be large to let a lot of light into the eye. And so sympathetic stimulation goes to these radial fibers right here, causes the radial fibers to contract, and that's going to pull on the circular fibers, and that's going to dilate the eye. Okay, so sympathetic stimulation causes pupillary dilation because of contraction of these radial fibers. Now, if it's really, really bright outside, right, it's not sympathetic tone that adjusts the pupil, it is parasympathetic. So in bright light, there's parasympathetic innervation going to the circular muscles, and when they contract, that causes pupillary constriction. All right, so under what conditions will your pupils be dilated right here? fight or flight, or rest and repose? Fight or flight, right, will cause pupil dilation. Okay, accommodation is a different kind of motion of the eye, and it allows you to keep an object in focus, whether it's close to you or far away. All right, so we're going to do just a really quick kind of experiment. And go ahead and put your hand out at arm's length in front of you. I'm going to turn this light off so it's not so bright. Okay, put it at arm's length, and then focus on your fingertip. All right, and you see stuff in the background. What does the stuff in the background look like? But focus your fingertip. Your fingertip should be nice and clear. What about the background? It's all blurry, right? And now, keep your fingertip right there and focus on somebody in the background. And what can you tell me about your fingertip? It's blurry, right? All right, so you can only focus on one distance at a time. You can't focus on everything, right? And as you bring your fingertip closer and closer and closer together, the stuff in the background even gets more blurry. That's what we call accommodation. So the structure inside the eye responsible for accommodation is most directly the lens right here. The lens can change shape, and therefore it's going to change its focusing power to keep an image focused on the retina. And how do you change the position of something or move something around inside your body? What's used for motility? The most common kind of tissue would be muscle tissue, right? And what can muscle tissue do? It can contract, okay, or it can relax. All right, so here is the lens that has to change shape. And attached to the lens, or what can pull on the lens, is this circular smooth muscle right here that we call the ciliary muscle, and the connection between the ciliary muscle and the lens right here are called suspensory ligaments. These are suspensory ligaments. Let's see what I got right here. Okay, let's see if I can figure this light out. So here we have a lens, right? The top case is thin. The bottom case is really thick. The lens can change shape. So for instance, when you're looking at something close up, the lens is going to have a lot of curvature. It's going to be very thick. But when you're looking at something far away, right, these suspensory ligaments are pulling on the lens, making it really flat. So it's not going to be such a powerful lens. Right? And the reason that changes is because when the muscle relaxes, let's think about the circular smooth muscle right here. When that muscle relaxes, what happens to the shape of that ciliary muscle? It actually gets bigger when the muscle relaxes. Okay, and remember that one property of muscle is elasticity. Right, so when a muscle relaxes, it goes back to its original shape. Right, so when the ciliary muscle relaxes, it gets bigger, and as it gets bigger, what happens to tension on these suspensory ligaments? It pulls more on the lens, right? So this is kind of counterintuitive. You might think that when the ciliary muscle contracts, that's when it pulls on the lens, but it's actually the opposite because the circular nature of the ciliary muscle. And when the ciliary muscle contracts, right, the circle gets smaller, and then what happens to the tension on these suspensory ligaments as the muscle contracts and the circle gets smaller? That releases the tension, and so now the lens can actually expand and get thicker. So you might have to look at that a couple times. Right, so when this muscle relaxes, that puts tension on these ligaments, that thins out the lens, and as the muscle contracts, the tension decreases, and the lens gets thicker so that you can see things in focus at different distances. We call that accommodation. Okay. So let me ask you a question. What's the primary structure in the eye that allows you to focus on something close up or far away, but of course you can't do both at the same time? What is that? That's the lens. That's the focusing power of the lens. And what changes the shape of the lens? It's got to be a muscle. That's the ciliary muscle that does that. Okay. So the curvature of the lens allows you to focus light on the retina. But But do you see anything else on this picture of an eye that kind of looks like a lens because it has curvature associated with it? Because if it's curved, it can bend light. And somebody did take a nice stab at that. And look at the cornea right here. It has curvature, right? So the cornea actually is the most important focusing structure of the eye. All right, the lens is there, not necessarily so that you can focus light on the eye, but so that you can make minor modifications on focusing on objects that are either close up or far away. Okay, so it has to do with the curvature of the lens. And that's why that LASIK procedure is actually so easy to do on a lot of people, right? So there are some folks that need a lot of correction in their glasses in order to see things in focus. And what the LASIK procedure does is that it changes the shape of the cornea right here so that people don't have to wear glasses because now images are clearly focused on the retina. And where's that cornea? Is it deep inside somebody's eye? It's very superficial, right? It's just right underneath some epithelium right here. So you don't really have to surgerize the eye very much in order to correct somebody's vision, right? But I still wouldn't recommend it for just cosmetic reasons, because with any surgical procedure, what can happen? Bad things, right? Things can go wrong. And what system are we talking about? Your visual system, and that's one of the things you wouldn't necessarily want to mess up, but typically it works pretty well. All right, but for instance, if your vision is so poor that you can't even find your glasses sometimes or in the morning, right, then a LASIK procedure is fantastic because it will change your life, right? You'll have really good vision. But what about your vision? Does it change over your lifetime? Sure, and the LASIK procedure can correct your vision for how many periods of time? Just one period of time. And your vision will change over your lifetime, and then that LASIK procedure won't necessarily correct your vision after that. And I think maybe they can redo LASIK now so that they can re-correct something that they corrected for. But again, I don't know if I really like that or not. Okay, so let's talk about how the eye does focus. All right, so light coming from an object, unlike these diagrams that we see in your book right here, light is actually diverging. It doesn't come to you in nice parallel rays. It's diverging, all right? But if it's coming from just a single point in space, and if it's going to diverge, and you look at that light, it's going to look blurry. In order for an object to be clear, right, the rays should all be focused at one point, just like where they're coming from, right? But they're diverging as they move away from the object. All right, so the job of the lens and the cornea right here is to bend light so that it actually just comes from a single point in space right here. All right, so in the normal eye, you have the right curvature of the cornea and the lens so that light that is actually curving away from the object that you're looking at is focused right on the retina, right on the back of the eyeball right here. And this is primarily due because the distance of the eyeball matches up exactly with the curvature of the cornea and the lens. So you can see nice sharp objects, so no correction is necessary. We call that emmetropia. But some people's eyeballs are a little bit too short, right? So that with the curvature of the cornea and the lens, we'll keep it the same as the first condition over here. Right, the retina is too close to the lens, so the object actually is focusing behind the retina. And so now, if you're looking at something that's just a point, what does it look like on your retina? It looks at it like a smudge instead of just a single point of light. All right, so that does not give you a very clear image. We call that hyperopia, or farsightedness. In order to correct for hyperopia, we need a convex lens that starts to bend the light even more before it reaches the eye, so that now it's focused closer up to the lens right on the retina right here. All right, myopia, on the other hand, we have somebody with an eyeball that is too long, so that with the same curvature of the cornea and the lens, the object is focused in front of the retina, and then it starts to diverge once again by the time it hits the retina. So again, it looks like a smudge instead of just a single point. So what we need to do is shift this focus point back to the retina. In this case, we call that myopia or nearsightedness. And the kind of lens that corrects for that is a concave lens. And this starts to bend the light away, right? It increases the divergence of the light. So now when it goes through the cornea and the lens, it focuses much farther away from the lens on the retina right here. And in most cases, people's eyes are really nice and symmetrical. It has the same curvature if you move in the superior or inferior direction, or it has the same curvature if you move from left to right, so that it's a nice spherical lens. But not all of us are like that. Some of us have a much different shape, so if we were to move in the inferior and superior direction, the curvature changes. So maybe the cornea is kind of flat on top, but nice and curved on the bottom over here. So now, light is going to be bent differently depending on whether light is coming in from the flat region or the nicely curved region. So when you look at a planar object, it's not all going to be in focus. Maybe some part, maybe the part on the bottom is going to be in focus, but not the part on the top, because the curvature is not the same. In which case, you need an uneven lens to correct for astigmatism. Right, and then everybody's going to be different. I don't know how they're doing with LASIK procedure to correct astigmatism, but I've heard they've done some pretty good work in that area too. Needs more work. I think probably LASIK needs more work. I think I'd be more interested in implants. Corneal implants or lens implants, little plastic rings. I know people are working on that, and maybe they could be transplanted. And what would be an advantage of a prosthesis like that, that's made out of plastic, compared to blasting away a part of your cornea with a laser? Because if you don't like what you see, you can take the implant out, right? And or maybe you could take that implant out and put another one in 10 or 20 years, right, without using a laser. Because remember, that laser is irreversible. You can't change that surgery. So I do kind of like the implant technique if that ever develops more. Maybe. Maybe I like glasses even more. Okay, because what do glasses do to your eye? They protect your eye from trauma, basically, right, from foreign bodies. And the cornea is a pretty delicate tissue. It can be damaged. And what do you have inside your eye? I'm sure you've talked about this in lab. I don't want to go over the anatomy of the eye, but what do you have inside your eye? You have fluids, yeah, you have liquids, right? And if the cornea is damaged, and what kind of fluid is in the anterior part of the eye? Aqueous humor is basically water. So if your cornea is perforated, that aqueous humor is just going to dribble right out of your eye, just like a tear running down your cheek, okay? And the terrible thing about that is that if we look at, let's see if I can go back. If we look at the layers of the eye, you got the cornea right here, and the iris is in there as well, and the lens. And if that aqueous humor leaks out, then the cornea can touch the iris, and the iris can touch the lens, and no one has ever figured out a way to unstick them, which is really terrible. All right, and what can you tell me about the iris? Is it just stationary, or is it moving around all the time? It's moving around all the time. What about the lens? Is it just there, or is it moving around all the time? It's moving around all the time under normal circumstances. So if they're stuck together, how are they going to be able to move around? They're not going to be able to, right? So that produces really severe vision deficits as a result of that. So I like glasses from that standpoint, especially if you're a guy and you like to ride motorcycles and, you know, work on engines and things like that. All right, always protect your eyes when you're in lab too. And the other thing is, what about the cornea? Not only will it, if you damage the cornea, will it produce vision deficits, but it's loaded with sensory receptors, right? Pain receptors. So when you damage the cornea, I've been told that you will experience the most exquisite sense of pain there is to experience, right? So that's another good reason to protect your corneas. All right, so let's talk about the retina. But let's think about the layers of the eye. What are the three main layers of the eye? I don't have a picture to show you. But you've got, on the outside, the eye, the white part, which is tough, a lot of connective tissue that protects the eye, gives the eye its shape. Then you got a middle layer called the, and I have that on the diagram. Oh, guess what? We got all three layers. Here's a sclera, right? Mostly connective tissue. There's a choroid, contains blood vessels, so that's going to nourish the inner parts of the eye. And then the inner layer is the retina, not drawn to scale, but so here is the retina. And the retina contains photoreceptor cells. Okay, the photoreceptor cells are either rods or cones, and you can, not really drawn to scale. The rods are actually bigger than the cone cells. Don't know how it ended up like that. All right, so you got two different kinds of cells, and they're nourished by the choroid right here. You don't have blood vessels running around inside the retina, because if you have a blood vessel running around inside the retina, guess what happens to these photoreceptor cells? They get pushed out of the way, right? And in order for you to perceive light, what do you need, a blood vessel or photoreceptor cell? Photoreceptor cell. So if these blood vessels ever start to grow up into the retina, that's going to produce blindness. And that happens, unfortunately, to some people. If we have time, maybe we can talk about that. All right, so the two kinds of photoreceptor cells are rods and cones. They're responsible for sensing different kinds of light. The rods are for black and white vision. The cone cells can actually see colors. So they have special little antennas in here, which we're going to talk about, that can be sensitive to different colors of light. Okay, and then they will send, right, via this system right here, action potentials to the brain. So the other kinds of cells we have besides the rods and cones, right, we've got these bipolar cells. Right, bipolar cells are characteristic of what kind of senses? Special senses, like for olfaction, okay, for hearing and for vision. Right, these amacrine cells, these horizontal cells, are just special signal processing cells, which we don't even talk about in this class, but they help process information before they even get to the nerves of the optic tract, the optic nerves taking visual information to the brain. All right, so notice that the rods and cones are deep inside the retina, and light actually has to pass through these ganglion cells and the amacrine cells and these bipolars before they even get to the rods and cones. Okay. All right, so where do we have these little receptors for light? If we look at a rod, see, here's a cone cell, nice and small. Here is a rod cell that's a lot bigger. So maybe you should think of a receptive field. Right? The size of this cell corresponds to the receptive field for a particular sensation. So if the receptive field is very large, you have high sensitivity in that region, okay? But what about resolution? Well, I tell you what, let's think about it this way. In terms of tactile receptive field, let's talk about your fingertips versus your back, right? And the receptive field on your back is very big, right? So it's pretty sensitive. Any stimulus on your back you will feel, but how well can you localize where that signal is coming from? Not very well. You can't tell. But on your fingertips, the receptive fields are small, right? So you can tell exactly where that stimulus is coming from. All right, so the same thing for these cells right here, the cone cell and the rod cell. A cone cell gives you very high resolution. It can give you very clear pictures, right? The rod cells, on the other hand, can't give you very clear pictures, right, because it has very low resolution, but they're highly sensitive because light coming in from any area right here, right, will stimulate the rod cell. All right, so that's a trade-off with these two different cells. The cone cell is good for high resolution, but you need bright light. You need high-intensity light in order to use them. Rod cells work in very dim light because there's a bigger receptive field, right, but your vision is going to be poor resolution. It's going to be more blurry compared to the cone cell. The other difference is that cone cells can produce color vision, rod cells only black and white vision. All right, so there are trade-offs, and they are located in different parts of your retina. All right, so cone cells are pretty much in the fovea centralis, or the macula lutea, which is the central part of your vision, and the rod cells populate your peripheral vision. So your central vision needs bright light in order to operate. So maybe sometime you should go out, oh, it's going to be really clear the next couple of nights, and look at a star up in the sky. Some stars you might be able to tell what color they are, but mostly they're just going to look white, I think, pretty much to most people. All right, but find a star and look right at it so that it's in your central vision. That light from the star is going to fall on cone cells. But in order for cone cells to work, what kind of light does it have to be? Really bright. And how is starlight? Is it bright or is it dim? I'm going to say it's dim. Okay? So if you're looking at a star, because it's coming from so far away, and if you look right in your central vision using a cone cell at a star, it's probably going to disappear. But if you move your vision just off to the side, so now light is not going through your central vision, it's going to peripheral vision. Which kind of cells are in the periphery? These rod cells right here that have higher sensitivity, right? That star will reappear again, okay, using these rod cells. But you won't be able to tell what color it is. There's some stars that have different colors to them. And if you find one with color, look to the side and you probably will notice that the color disappears. But it looks how? Brighter. Okay, it should look brighter as a result. Okay. All right, so how does this work? Oh, let's look at these, the outer segment right here. There are discs within the outer segment of both of these kinds of cells that have special membranes associated with them. And within those membranes, there are chemicals that are called rhodopsin. So what we're going to really refine our discussion around is just for the rod cells and not for the cone cells. Okay, so here is rhodopsin. It's got a couple different molecules. It's got opsin right here, which is a protein, and then another compound called retinol. Right, and retinol can change shape depending on whether it can absorb light or not. Right, so when rhodopsin, which is this molecule right here, in the absence of light, it has this curved kind of shape. Right, so that it can bind to opsin, so retinol can bind to opsin. But when light is absorbed by retinol, it changes shape, becomes straighter, and when it's straighter, it can no longer fit on the surface of this opsin molecule. So this reaction right here is what we call bleaching. This is a bleaching reaction. And this bleaching reaction causes a change in the permeability of the cell membrane of what kind of cell? These rods right here, yeah, it changes permeability of ions to the rod cells. And when you change permeability of ions to a cell, what else is changing in that cell? If ions can diffuse in or out, what's going to happen? What properties of the cell are changing? Yeah, like the electrical properties, in particular, membrane potential. The membrane potential is going to change as a result. Membrane potential is going to change as a result of this bleaching reaction. Okay, so this visual transduction that I'm going to talk about right now is inverse to many other sensory systems. So in the dark, the photoreceptor cells are actually activated, but they release an inhibitory neurotransmitter that hyperpolarizes the bipolar neurons. But in light, right, these photoreceptor cells are inhibited. How do you inhibit something? You depolarize or hyperpolarize? You hyperpolarize, right? So in light, the rod cells are hyperpolarized, and it stops releasing neurotransmitter, but this is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. Therefore, the bipolar cells are going to be stimulated. Okay. So rod cells and cones contain many sodium channels that are open in the dark. So in the dark, what about rods and cones if these sodium channels are open? They are being depolarized. They're being stimulated. Right? And in the dark, that sodium current, right, is what we call a dark current. So sodium is entering the cell causing depolarization in the absence of stimulus. When light is turned on, the sodium channels are closed, and that hyperpolarizes the cell, and that then inhibits the release of neurotransmitter from the rod and cone cells. All right, so let's look a little bit more. Let's put some graphics associated with this. Okay, so here we have a disc, okay, within the outer segment of a rod cell, right? And in this membrane right here, you have the retinol molecule bound to rhodopsin, and you also have some G proteins. Now, what you don't have is a receptor, right? You don't have a ligand receptor. The receptor that you have now has been substituted with retinol, which is basically an antenna for light because it can absorb light, right? So in the dark, here we have a sodium channel. So here's a plasma membrane of a rod cell. It is normally open. There is a binding site on the inside of the membrane for cyclic GMP, right? And so in the dark, there's plenty of cyclic GMP to bind to this ligand-gated channel, and it is open, so sodium can enter the cell. And when sodium is entering the cell, what's happening? Is it depolarizing or hyperpolarizing? Depolarizing, right? That's just your classical understanding of when sodium enters the cell, right? It becomes less negative, therefore we call that depolarization. Inside the cytosol, there's an enzyme called phosphodiesterase. We haven't talked about phosphodiesterase yet, but we will. Phosphodiesterase, of course, has to do with what? Has to do with some phosphate kind of groups. And what molecule have we talked about already that has a phosphate group on it in this slide? Yeah, the cyclic GMP right here. So phosphodiesterase, right, works on cyclic GMP. So cyclic GMP is the substrate, and it will break it down, right? But in the dark, phosphodiesterase is in what kind of condition? It is inactive. So what happens to cyclic GMP in the dark? It stays around because this degrading enzyme, the phosphodiesterase, is in an inactive form. All right, so let's shine some light on this cell. So light comes in, and it causes a conformation change on basically the receptor, which is what? Retinol. And that causes dissociation of the G protein. The alpha subunit bumps into the phosphodiesterase, and it changes the activity of phosphodiesterase so that it becomes active. Right? And so then phosphodiesterase breaks cyclic GMP down into just the regular old GMP. It breaks the ring structure of cyclic GMP down so that it's now just a linear molecule. And when it changes shape, can it bind to this ligand-gated channel right here? No longer has the proper shape. It comes off, and that causes a conformation change in the sodium channel to where it closes, and that shuts off that sodium current. And what happens to the cell now when sodium can't get into the cell? It hyperpolarizes, right? So it is inhibited. So this rod cell becomes inhibited in the light due to this mechanism right here. It hyperpolarizes. All right, I want to show you a couple more slides. All right, so here we have the whole system diagram. We've got a nice rod cell, and then here's a bipolar, and then here's the ganglion cell, which is going to send action potentials to, oh, what part of the brain? What part of the brain do visual signals go to? Like the occipital lobe, right? The visual cortex, occipital lobe. I know you all knew that. Okay, it goes eventually to the occipital lobe. All right, so here we have a couple rod cells. First condition is in the dark. Second condition is in the light, when there's light shining on it. All right, so in the dark, in the absence of stimulus, right, here we have this sodium channel opened. Right, and why is it kept open in the dark? Because there's high levels of cyclic GMP inside the cell because the phosphodiesterase is inactive in dark conditions. Right, so in the dark conditions, we have sodium going in, right, but of course we have the sodium-potassium pump working all the time. That kicks the potassium out, so that maintains the balance of the cell. But nonetheless, in the dark, this cell is depolarized, which is what? Excited. So when the cell is excited, what can you tell me about release of neurotransmitter? When a cell depolarizes, that causes release of neurotransmitter, on this bipolar cell. But remember, neurotransmitters can have two different actions. What can they do? They can be excitatory or inhibitory depending on what their activity is on the postsynaptic cell. And so this neurotransmitter is causing graded potentials on this cell, but what kind of graded potentials? Two kinds, EPSPs or IPSPs. But since this is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, it's producing IPSPs on the bipolar cell. And what does an IPSP produce on a cell? Inhibition or excitation? Inhibition. So even though this rod cell is depolarizing, it is causing the inhibition of this bipolar cell under what conditions? In the dark condition right here. So action potentials aren't being sent to the brain as a result of that. So that's why we say this is what? Opposite compared to most sensory systems. All right, so in the dark you have this sodium current in the rod cell releasing inhibitory neurotransmitter on this bipolar, and so as a result, no action potentials go to the visual cortex. But in light, right, there's a bleaching reaction, right, so that the subunit from the G protein activates phosphodiesterase that depletes the cell of cyclic GMP, which then closes this sodium channel right here. And as a result, what happens to the rod cell when the sodium channel closes? Okay, it hyperpolarizes, so now we just have potassium leaving the cell. It's another reason for hyperpolarization. So that inhibits the rod cell, so it doesn't release neurotransmitter. Right? And if no inhibitory neurotransmitter is released, the bipolar cell depolarizes, causing release of excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell, which sends action potentials to the brain in light conditions. Okay, so I do want you to know something about this dark current due to the sodium channel that's open, and the rod cells have this inhibitory neurotransmitter, which then regulates the action of this bipolar cell, either sending action potentials to the brain in the light or not sending action potentials to the brain in the dark. All right, the other thing that you might notice, even in with this particular scheme right here, that even under dark conditions, when the retina is not being stimulated, how much ATP is necessary to keep the cell alive and functioning normally? A lot, because why? This sodium-potassium pump requires ATP. So even in dark conditions, the retina requires a lot of oxygen and nutrients to stay healthy because of this sodium-ATP pump. And probably you know some circumstances, some pathological conditions where a person's energy metabolism is terribly disturbed. Because how does a cell make most of its ATP? Electron transport. And what's the energy input energy molecule to electron transport? That's Krebs cycle. Krebs cycle is driven by glycolysis. And what drives glycolysis? What's the energy molecule that has to go through glycolysis? Glucose, right. Okay. And what kind of condition do these rod cells actually starve to death because they can't get glucose? They use up all their ATP?
Diabetes.
And what's one organ that's very sensitive to diabetes? What happens to a lot of diabetic patients if they don't control their glucose? Yeah, they go blind. Okay, because all the time, the retina is very active, requires a lot of ATP, okay? Okay, so that's just an unfortunate consequence. All right, well, maybe ask me some questions about any of this stuff right here. Yes. So we're talking a cornea. Is that what you asked, or the lens? I was cornea. Yeah, they just remove it. It's there's an epithelium on top of the cornea. I'm not really knowledgeable with the procedure, but it's probably just removed with a scalpel. okay, and then put in a nice oxygenated container, small vial, and I don't know how long it can last. I would guess not very long, you know, probably not 2 weeks, maybe a day or something. And then if somebody needs a cornea because it's damaged or it's opaque, then it is just sewn in with very specific kinds of sutures. Okay, and the sutures, of course, are in the periphery. That's going to destroy your peripheral vision a little bit, but, you know, if your central vision is good, then you're in pretty good shape. Now, the shape of that cornea, I don't know if they test for the shape of a cornea for a recipient. I think it's mostly based on the antigenic properties, if it's a match. Yeah, and if the shape of the cornea is not right, then I think you just have glasses after that. But it's mostly just an antibody. That's what they're probably mostly concerned with. Okay, so that can restore somebody's vision, but there are problems with that, because anytime you accept human tissue into your body, okay, there's a rejection, but there's also a possibility of transferring infection. So that's something else you have to worry about. So, and the most common kind of deadly disease you can get from a transplant is, you might be thinking of AIDS or something, but hepatitis probably is worse. Okay, different forms of hepatitis, because that might set you up for another kind of transplant down the future. So if somebody has hepatitis, yeah, you might be needing a liver later on, right, because of cirrhosis that it produces. But I had a friend elect to do that, cornea transplant, and he was really happy with it. Yeah, another question? Yes. And nearsighted, you can focus on near objects. Okay. And it's based on the shape of your eye, the length of the eye, the distance between the lens and the retina. Okay. And that distance can change all the time. And as you get older, some people's vision actually gets better. It all depends on how the retina moves, if it moves in the right direction or the wrong direction. So, again, I guess that's another reason why I'm not really big on LASIK procedure, because your vision might get better as you get older normally, and then if you get the LASIK procedure, what's going to happen? The LASIK procedure is actually going to make it worse. All right, so then you'll need glasses. Oh, but what's the worst thing about LASIK procedure? I forgot. We got a couple seconds to talk about that, I think. For instance, right now, I have really good vision. Okay, I do need some correction. Okay. For instance, if I want to look at something up close, well, I'm wearing glasses so I can see far away. And if I look at something up close, guess what? My glasses that correct for my far vision interfere with my near vision. So in order to see something close up, I have to take my glasses off. All right, so now I can see something really clear up close, but what about my far vision? It's kind of destroyed, right? So there's a trade-off between far and near vision, right? And guess what? LASIK does exactly the same thing, right? So now, instead of thinking of glasses, think I got a LASIK procedure. If I got a LASIK procedure, where do I see things really clearly? Far away, and it's corrected perfectly, or even better than perfectly, but now if I look up close, what do I see? It's like wearing glasses, everything is blurry. Okay, so there's no magic there. Glasses, corrective lenses, and LASIK produce the same things because of the physics involved. All right, so I've known a lot of people to get a LASIK procedure, and in less than a second, your vision is corrected perfectly so you can see far away, but what else gets destroyed in less than a second? Your near vision gets destroyed. All right, and some doctors, I guess, previously didn't tell patients that that was going to happen. So they would walk in, get LASIK procedure, walk outside and see the world beautifully in color and clear, and then get a call on their cell phone and get the cell phone out of their pocket, and guess what? Couldn't see the phone to use the cell phone, couldn't make a telephone call. And so now what do you have to have in order to read or use a cell phone? Even though you have LASIK to see far away, you need reading glasses to see up close. All right, so that's just a trade-off. So hopefully, you know, if you ever elect for a LASIK procedure, you go to a guy or gal that's really reputable and will tell you all these things. I know people are really upset that they can't use their cell phone, like after LASIK surgery, without reading glasses. Okay. It just would be for close up, anything close up. And sometimes it's really important to have good close up vision. Okay, like if you get a sliver or something, or if you want to read something. Okay. Alright, so that's it for senses chapter. So next week we're going to start endocrinology. And I'm almost learning how to talk with this microphone on, but still I find it very confusing sometimes. I have a hard time thinking when I hear myself so loud. Not yet. Maybe just 9 and 10. Maybe just 9 and 10. Yeah. Oh, 9, 10, 11. Oh, 11. No, yeah, 9, 10, 11. I'll try to look over the weekend. I tell you what, I want to turn this off for a second.